in today's Torah portion is the first instance of forgiveness in the Bible. Genesis 50:15. Then Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead. They said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers had come and fell down before him, and behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So they ask for forgiveness. He does not specifically say, "I forgive you," but he, in essence, does say that. Now, there's a number of things we can talk about around this incident. And I guess the first one I want to talk about, and Rabbi Sachs was talking about this last week, Joseph had a really hard row to hoe. He is the third generation to get kicked out of the family. So Ishmael gets kicked out, Esau gets kicked out, and Joseph gets kicked out. So Joseph grows up knowing the history of the family. He knows about great-grandfather Abraham, grandfather Isaac, and so forth, and the fact that those that are not in the line of the Messiah, essentially, I mean, that's what it's going to wind up being, wind up getting kicked out of the family. So Abraham's second wife, you know, he has a whole bunch of kids with her, settles a little bit of property on them, and ships them out of town. So they are essentially kicked out of the family. And by the way, that is the source of a lot of the problems in the Middle East today. Those branches of the family that were kicked out are still grumpy about it. So they're still trying to come back and destroy the main line of the family because they're still looking for the blessing. So anyway, there's an opportunity there for Joseph to also be grumpy. And one of the things that you can tell is when he gets his wife and has two children. What he names the first one is Manasseh, means forgetfulness, exactly. So what he's saying is, I've been kicked out. And of course the second one, Ephraim, means I have been fruitful in my new circumstances. So there's every opportunity for him to hold anger and resentment to the rest of the family who kicked him out. And what he does is he is able to reframe the situation in light of a bigger picture. So he's able to pop out of, this is what happened to me by my rotten brothers, and he's able to pop it up a level and reframe it and say, this is what God had in mind with this whole circumstance. And so now I can forgive my brothers, and even though they did act kind of rotten, because they were acting as part of a greater plan that God had to save the life of the people. God used the rottenness of my brothers in order to save the entire family through me. And so he pops it up a level, and in that way he is able to turn loose of his resentment. So that's sort of thing one. One of the ways to get rid of resentment is to reframe the thing and get yourself out of the center of the picture and get yourself into somebody else's bigger picture and look at it from the bigger picture perspective, and there you can see yourself as an actor in somebody else's larger picture and you cease to be the center of attention. And if you can get yourself out of being the center of attention, you then have an opportunity to turn loose of resentment. Thing two was in today's Rabbi Sachs vignette. And he was quoting a gal by the name of Hannah Arendt. She was a philosopher, born in Germany, had gotten kicked out of Germany in 1933. had to flee Germany and went from there to Paris and then to the United States, where she was an academic. And this sort of dovetails with what Matthew was saying this morning, and I hadn't thought of it in exactly the way he phrased it, but the idea that God's laws are eternal and unchanging, and what we're seeing is a projection of those laws from however many dimensions God has to the, relatively speaking, two-dimensional world we live in. The analogy used was of a shadow. You put your hand over here and you're looking at the shadow of your hand. You can see five fingers and you can watch them wiggle, whereas if you turn your hand this way, it looks like a line. So the hand is the same, but the projection varies according to how it's held with respect to the light. And what I will suggest to you is the thing that causes that reflection to happen is time. And this is where Hannah Arendt comes in. What she said is, we live in time. And she doesn't say we're prisoners of time, because that would take us off into Gnosticism. Although that is not an unreasonable way to think about it, is you're trapped in time. But the concept of being trapped in time is a Gnostic idea, and I don't really want to go there. But we are in time, and we can't get out of time. We're like a fish doesn't know it's wet. It just is. So we're floating through time, and that's where we live. And one of the things about time is you can't see the future. You know, we live in 3.5 dimensions, right? Length, width, height, and time. Time is half a dimension. You can move forward and look back, but you cannot look forward and move back. So in that sense, it's only half a dimension. So you can't ever go back and change anything you've done. So everything that you have done is done permanently and cannot be changed. Furthermore, since you cannot look forward, you never know what the consequences of your actions are going to be. Take an example. I just teased Tom about his midrash, and I made very clear that I hoped everybody understood I was teasing. I very rarely tease people, because people take me seriously when I tease, and then I have to go back and try and repair the damage that I've done inadvertently. So I never know how people are going to take what I just said. We have things like Proverbs and Ecclesiastes that tell us in general terms that behaving in these ways is not wise, because the consequences of that kind of behavior are going to be things that you are not going to like. But you really don't know what's going to happen next until it actually happens. We can look at case studies and so forth and say, okay, under these circumstances, so-and-so did this and this is what happened. Huh, maybe I don't want to do that, or maybe I do want to do that, you know, depending on what's going on. You can live life wisely and prudently and hope that most of the time the things that you do will turn out as you hope they will, but you never know. That's a consequence now of being, as a shorthand, trapped in time. You have actions that you're going to take, and you cannot ever undo those actions. For example, if Tom had taken my teasing the wrong way and had turned red in the face and sort of slumped over and left the room, I could certainly run after Tom and say, Tom, I was teasing. I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. In that way, I could try and repair it, but I can never unsay what I said, and it's always there. I can hope to repair it, but no better than my ability to predict the effects of what I do. So my attempts to repair may work, they may not work, they may be partially successful, whatever, but I don't know that until I try. So the whole deal here is we're in this matrix, if you will, where we can't see what's going to happen, and we can't go back and fix what we did. All you can do is do what you're going to do, observe the consequences, adjust, and move forward. And that's where forgiveness comes in. And forgiveness, I will suggest to you, is one of those two-dimensional projections of a three-dimensional thing that is important in this creation, but will not be important in the next creation. It is a mechanism that's absolutely necessary for creatures who live in time. Remember, time is a created thing. Remember, it says, in the beginning of what? The beginning of time. So time is a created thing, and so in the new heaven and the new earth, just as perhaps gravity will be different, time, I expect, will also be different. Don't know how, but I expect it will be different. And in this creation, what God has given us is the mechanism of forgiveness to allow us successfully to live in the flow of time. What forgiveness does is it allows both of us, the one who is injured and the one who does the injury, to take that incident, which can never be undone, and reframe it and move it off into another dimension and say, all right, we both are now going to go on without having that incident that has been forgiven between us. Notice both people benefit from forgiveness. The person who does the injury benefits from the forgiveness because he is freed from the burden of this thing that he has done that he cannot undo. The person who was injured benefits from forgiveness because he doesn't have to carry around anger and resentment anymore. Now, where Sachs goes from there is also kind of cool, I think. I hope most of you have been here when we've talked about the various kinds of time. There is cyclical time and linear time, and there's also covenant time. Cyclical time is what you see in Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. Everything that is to be has been before. The seasons go around and around. The week goes around and around. Everything comes back to where it began. That's cyclical time. Linear time, which was invented actually in the 19th century during the Enlightenment, says that things are moving in a direction, and that's what gives rise to the idea of progress. And it also gives rise to the idea of optimism. Cyclical time gives rise to resignation. Resignation, acceptance, whatever, that, okay, this is the cycle, this is the spring, this is what we do in the spring, spring is going to come again in next year, this is Shabbat, we do this every Shabbat, Shabbat's going to come 7 days from now, and everything just cycles. Linear time gives rise to the idea of progress, that things are moving and getting better. And then optimism is an outgrowth of progress. And then covenant time says that you are in a covenant relationship and that there's a plan in that covenant and that there is a goal that we are moving toward, and that gives rise to hope. Now, hope and optimism are not the same thing. They're close, but they're not quite the same. Optimism and its twin pessimism, both of them are functions of linear time, is the idea that the universe is fundamentally good and everything will eventually work out for the best, or the universe is fundamentally bad and shit happens, you know, that kind of thing. So those are functions of linear time. Covenant time, which gives rise to hope, is that there is a directing person who is running the whole thing, and he has a plan towards which we are working. The universe isn't necessarily good or necessarily bad, but the covenant maker is good, and the covenant maker has a plan for the moving of time. Subtle difference between hope and optimism. And the thing that Sachs notes is there aren't any completed stories in this book. You have Abraham who had the promise, you're going to go down and you're going to eventually get this land, and at the end of Genesis, Joseph dies. None of that's happened. And none of his descendants in the land, he's not in the land, so it just sort of quits. And then we're going to take up Exodus and so forth. But the idea is that covenant time is open-ended. We see that there's a plan and we're moving toward a plan, but all of the vignettes and stories that we have gone through, none of them come to a conclusion because the plan is not yet complete. So all you see is the part that each of the players has in that plan, but none of the players sees the completion. I mean, it's not like a movie where at the end of your 2 hours you have this nice resolution and everything is tied up and we're done. That isn't what happens in Scripture. The only way to understand that is to understand that this is part of a larger plan that is millennia long. It's like Moses. Moses goes through the entire Torah. And at the end of the Torah, there's no resolution for Moses. He dies. He's buried on a hillside. Nobody knows where he is, and he never gets to see the completion of his work. And what he has to do is he has to trust that God will keep his promises and that the prophecies and so forth going forth will come true. And at some point, he will be raised from the dead. And at some point, he will, in fact, see the land that has been promised him. But I don't think any other religion deals in forgiveness. Now, there's a difference between forgiveness and retribution. Retribution is you try and get even. And that's how you balance the scales. In forgiveness, there isn't any retribution. Every society has a way of dealing with damage from one to another. And I think Judaism and Christianity are the only ones that use forgiveness. I think everybody else is based on retribution. Please consider becoming a sponsor. Please visit crimsonthread.com/purpose for an explanation of what we're doing and perhaps to become a sponsor. Thank you.